All right. Welcome to this month's Utah Ions presentation. My name's Martin Tanner. I'm a member of our local Board of Trustees. If you're joining us for the first time or have been on our Zoom presentations many times, this might be a review, but on the bottom left hand of most screens, please be sure your mute button on your microphone is on so that your speaker is off. And you should also do the same with your video so that everyone isn't watching what you're doing as we move through the event tonight. I would also invite you to go to the top right corner of your screen and hit presenter's view, or however it's listed in your version of Zoom that you have on your computer. If you choose presenter's view, then you'll have a large screen of whoever's speaking instead of just some small little rectangle somewhere that's difficult to see. We welcome you all here. We have a little bit different of an arrangement tonight, which Craig Miller will describe to you. But before he does that, I'd like to make a couple of general comments. For those of you who are not familiar with Utah Ions, we're one of the oldest local chapters of Ions. We've been around since the late 1980s, so over 30 years. And Ions is locally here in Utah and nationally and internationally around for several important purposes. One of those is to help people who have had near-death experience, because it's not always as fabulous and wonderful as some people often think it must be. We're also here to support loved ones of family members who have had a near-death experience, because sometimes it's hard for those who are friends and family members of those who have had near-death experience to understand them afterwards, because they often change a great deal. We're also involved in study and research of near-death experiences, which dovetails into the fourth purpose, which is to provide information and research on near-death experiences to those who are interested in the subject. This organization has helped many, many people. I would invite everybody to hold your questions until the end of the presentation tonight. When you're done, just use the dialogue box to ask a question. We would love to be able to have people to ask it out loud individually, but if we do that, it will turn into chaos with all the microphones. So please hit the chat box to ask a question. We're also pleased to announce, and Craig is going to announce this as well, because we want everybody to remember it, that next month we will be open again at our auditorium location at 21st South and State Street. We will also simulcast next month online. So if you would like to be involved online, you can do that. But we highly encourage you to come in person if you can, because it's always richer in person. I hesitate to say that because not everybody can join us in person, but we encourage you to come in person if you can. And with that, I'm going to turn the time over to Craig to announce our meeting tonight and what has happened to it, and we'll move on from there.
Yes, what has happened to our meeting? So Ty Burrell has an excellent story, and I'm sure everybody will be uplifted by that, but we can't have it this month. Apparently he's so ill he can't speak, so that wouldn't benefit us very much in this kind of a forum, unless he was able to write very quickly what he was trying to say. So instead, we've got our two co-founders of the Ions group. Our local Ions group was founded by a group of three individuals, Martin.
Yes, and mainly three individuals. Arfin Gibson, who's passed away, Lynn Johnson, and me.
Yes. So Martin Tanner and Lynn Johnson co-founded the IONS group that we have, and they have a fabulous amount of experience with NDEs. And tonight they're going to pitch it for Ty and or in place of Ty, and tell us some of the things that they've learned over the years that they believe are important that we should be discussing and understanding. And so with that, I'm going to give it over to Lynn Johnson, who is our first speaker.
Nice to be here, Craig. It's what a fun topic this is. It's a great experience for everybody to hear these events. I don't know if it's important for you to see much of me. I'm in a little tiny box in the upper left-hand corner. In the about 1976 or 77, I was just a young fellow. I sat down with my grandfather, Joseph Johnson, and I interviewed him, and I had a 90-minute tape, and I filled both sides of the tape, and he was a good interview. He was surprisingly able to remember his teachers and people he met in the second grade and the third grade and the fourth grade and things like that. He had just a pretty astonishing memory. And we went through the events that had made him who he was. I'm going to give you a real short overview of that. When he was 15, he went over from Tropic, Utah, which is at the foot of Bryce Canyon, and he went over the mountain to Beaver, and he attended high school there. And he worked for a fellow there for room and board. And sadly, around Christmas time, he froze his hands. And so they said they wrapped his hands up and got a horse, and a man led him back over that road back to Tropic. When he got there, the whole town came out, and it turned out that his father had just died. That was the end of my grandfather's education. He had to go to work on the ranch. And he kept the ranch going for a few years. And then when he was 19, he thought that his younger siblings and his mother could keep the ranch going. He moved up to Salt Lake, and he went to work in the copper mines to try to generate income. As he explained all this, Aunt Myrtle was his second wife. My grandmother died, and he remarried. Aunt Myrtle calls from the other room, and Joe, why don't you tell him about that experience you have at the mine? Oh, I don't know if he'd be interested or not. I'm interested, Grandpa. Tell me. So one day, he was leaning back against a beam, eating his lunch. For no reason that anybody could figure out, he just came right up out of his body. And he said, oh, the joy that I felt, the pleasure, I just would think of going somewhere and I'd zip off towards that place. And then he said a strange thought hit him. He thought, I left my jacket back there. So he went back, and he said he bent down and took a hold of his jacket. And as soon as he touched his jacket, he was back in his body. And he got kind of sad, and he said, never fear death. It's the most wonderful thing you can imagine. Now that night, my father had picked some apricots, and he and I were bottling these apricots, and so I played him the tape. And when we got to the end of the tape, my dad was kind of knocked off his feet. He went over and picked up the phone and called his brother and said, "Sheldon, you need to listen to this tape Lynn has made of Dad. There are things on here I've never heard before." Now, what I think, and I think you'll find this very commonly with people who've had near-death experiences. As a rule, people don't like to talk about them. The fellow that was going to present tonight, Ty, he hasn't really talked to anyone about his experience except to me and his family members. The trouble is that his family members kind of reject that idea. They don't like him talking about it. That's very common. People tend not to talk about it. Look, now, Martin, let me do one more quick story, and then I'm going to throw the ball to Martin Tanner. There was a woman that I interviewed, and she had a remarkable out-of-body experience. A surgery went very badly for her. And she was in the hospital, and suddenly she was out of her body. Her mother was sitting next to the bed crying because it looked like her daughter might in fact die. And she felt so free. She felt so alive. So, and she said she went out to the waiting room and she felt she could zip around the corner just really quickly and zip here and zip there. And she thought that was great fun. And then she felt herself being drawn up through the roof of the hospital towards a light that was directly behind her. She wasn't looking at the light. She could see it though. There's sometimes people will tell you from near-death experiences, it's not an uncommon thing. I could see in 360 degrees all the way around me. I could see behind me, in front of me. You're not seeing with your eyes. Pretty neat trick. She was floating up towards that light, but looking down at the hospital where her body was. And then all of a sudden, it turned around and she zipped back down through the roof of the hospital into her body. Now, for the next probably 25 or 30 years. Number one, she never told anyone about that experience. Number two, she lost interest in the church she had been raised in because she thought the priests don't know. In fact, she told to me, she said, "For 30 years, I thought I was the only one on earth that knew." Well, when I heard that, that broke my heart. I thought, the loneliness of that kind of a message. I mean, it was wonderful. It was freeing. It was. She did go through a wall at one point and felt like that was a pretty amazing thing. But also the loneliness. And so at some point, Martin found out that I was doing these near-death experiences. And He interviewed me on his radio show, and my gosh, I had a great time talking to him. And then he and I got together, and we talked about it. And this lonely experience of I was the only one on earth who knew. I thought we have to make a support group for people. And Martin totally agreed, and Arvin Gibson totally agreed, and we put together the Utah Ions. And Martin has been here. He's been a pillar of the group since, gosh, at least 1990, I would say, 89 or 90. And so he's been like a like a tree planted by the river. And he's got some really great stories that he's going to tell you now.
Okay. I will give it a shot. Thanks, Lynn. Great story about your grandfather. There are a number of stories that, and at this point, I should mention that I've, according to my estimates, interviewed over 600 or so people who have had near-death experiences. And that's a lot. And to sort through those and pick what might be of most value tonight, I've thought about the people whose lives have been changed the most or who have had an experience that might be unusual or of interest to people listening. And so I'm going to pick a few experiences that in a few cases I know you will have never have heard, and in some other cases, some experiences that you might have heard a little bit about. The first one that I wanted to bring up is a case about pets, because a lot of people hear about near-death experiences and so-and-so was injured and had one and they went to heaven and came back, but people are often very close to their pets and they wonder, do dogs or cats or other animals go to heaven? That's a fascinating question. If you try to sort through the near-death literature, there's not much about that. One of the first cases that I heard that dealt with pets was a man named Frank Morgan, who in 2013 was really down and out on his luck. And he was living in a kind of a slumlord's apartment, and he was really depressed. He lost his job, and his pet dog, his only real friend in life, had died the month before. And so he was just having a horrible time. So the gist of what happened to Frank was that it was such a shoddy apartment that there was a gas leak. And while he was asleep at night, his apartment was filling up with fumes that would have eventually killed him. And at one point he got up and didn't feel well and fell down and cracked his head open on the floor and started to bleed and was unconscious. And fortunately, in the intervening few moments here, a neighbor came over and discovered all this. But between the time that he cracked his head open and his neighbor discovering him and the paramedics arriving, Frank found himself in this wonderful place. He left his physical body and went off. And who was there but his dog, his favorite companion, who had been there with him and died just a month or so beforehand. And he said, the fascinating thing about it, Martin, was that I could understand what my dog was thinking. And I said, well, tell me about that. I've run into people who think, gosh, if only I could talk to my poodle Fifi, you know, she'd tell me that she could do quadratic equations and advanced calculus, and I'm sure she's really smart. And he said, no, nothing like that. But I could tell what he was thinking. He still had the mind and abilities of a dog, but I could grasp what he was trying to convey. And I could tell he was concerned about me and that he knew that I needed to go back, that I was in trouble. And he kept telling me, in essence, go back, get up, go back, get up, that kind of a thought. And so I tried to do what my dog was telling me, he said, and he went back, and it was right then that the paramedics had arrived and were trying to help him up off from the floor. And he eventually, of course, made a full recovery. And he said that he was thrilled with the prospect of meeting up in the future at some point with his dog, who was absolutely sure was going to be there, and who was at that point in his life one of the only friends he had had in a long, long time. So I thought that was quite sweet. And since then, I have accumulated quite a few near-death experiences that involved mostly dogs, a few cats, a horse, and a few other animals. But animals are apparently a part of heaven, even though we often don't hear them as part of near-death experiences. With that, Lynn, I think I will toss it back to you quickly, and then we'll sort of go back and forth and give some ideas and thoughts about what's the very most important lessons that we learn from some of these experiences. Lesson number one for me, pets are in heaven.
That's great. That's great. I am babysitting my grand dog today, and so she may come in and make some noise, but pets have always been an important part of our family. We love them, and we're always thrilled to see them. I learned a fascinating thing about animals. A kid that we knew about adopted a Rottweiler and then discovered that the apartment that he lived in wouldn't allow pets. And so, you know, when you're 20 or so, long-term planning is like 15 minutes into the future. And so he was going to take this Rottweiler to the pound. And we had a dog, but it kind of upset me because Rotties are great big dogs. They're 100, 150 pounds easily. And big dogs are kind of hard to adopt and hard to get them out. So I took the dog. And she was a young Rottie, 6, 8 months old. I took her for a run. Rottweilers resent running. Labradors resent running. So if you're going to run with a Rottie or a Lab, it has to be when they're quite young. We ran down the street and we ran past a place where there were cattle in the field. And Sophie, the dog, kept looking over at those cattle, and she'd look over at them and look over at them and look over at them. We turned a corner and she kept looking back over her shoulder. So I got home and we had an encyclopedia. Now, an encyclopedia was a set of books that was kind of like the internet, only it was much smaller. And I looked up Rottweiler in the encyclopedia, and it turns out Rottweiler is an ancient breed designed to herd cattle. So as she ran past those cattle, they were speaking to her. They were saying, "Sophie, we're important to you. Pay attention." Now, I'm going to tell you two experiences that I got from some of our cherished NDE survivors, and I think it kind of illustrates something that's worth thinking about. It's like when Sophie got to Earth, she was primed for a certain mission. Now, the fact is, Rottweilers don't herd cattle anymore. Mainly, they just scare people, I suppose. They look like a big, scary dog, but it was what she was made to do. Elaine Durham and her husband had a catering business in Indiana, and they wanted to add to their catering business. And they decided that if they sent Elaine to a class in Chicago on making wedding cakes, it would be an additional source of income for them. So she goes up and she's taking this class and making wedding cakes, and suddenly she went into a seizure. She just seized and seized and seized, and which it's very very dangerous if you go into a seizure and you don't come out of it and they can't stop you from seizing, you can die. And she died. And she said, she had a little cross around her neck. They called a Catholic priest in case she was Catholic. He gave her last rites. They took her body to the morgue, which is where she wakes up later on. Well, she had a rather interesting near-death experience. She traveled through a tunnel, and she saw, as she was moving towards the light at the end of the tunnel, that there were people in the darkness. And she realized she could sense something about them without even knowing who they were. She sensed that those people in the darkness would not look at the light. They could see it if they simply wanted to, but they wouldn't look. And she got to the light, and Jesus was there, and he invites her into this paradise-like place. It was a beautiful place. And she met a guy, and he had a very red beard, and she thought that was unusual. And she got the sense that he was an angel, and she also got the sense that he was a prophet. And she didn't understand how both of those could be true at the same time, because in her thinking, angels were different than humans, and angels wouldn't become humans, or after humans died, they wouldn't be angels, or something like that, her understanding. And so he gave her a tour around heaven, and suddenly he says, "Elaine, would you like to see yourself before you were born?" Well, that struck her like a thunderbolt. Before I was born. And she had no concept that there'd been an experience that she had lived before she was in her earthly state. And she said, sure. She saw a vision, and she was seated in front of something that looked a little like a mirror, some kind of crystalline structure. But it wasn't exactly a mirror, because she could see trajectories that her earth life could take. And as she sat there, she was choosing certain challenges, this challenge, that challenge, this challenge, that challenge. She said she saw that there were five angels with her, spirits. And she said three of them were senior angels and two of them were training angels. Which I thought, well, that was interesting. You know, you have to be trained to be an angel, I guess. And the training angels were getting very upset. They were saying, no, no, it's too hard. She's making too many hard choices. Her life's going to be too difficult. And the senior angels said, no, you calm down. She wants to learn everything she can from her earth life. And so she has to make difficult choices. Second experience was our friend Don Wood. Don had cystic fibrosis. And Don's age at the time was 36. He was pleased to be 36 years old. He thought he'd never live that long. And he was in the hospital, and it was 2 o'clock in the morning. And he popped out of his body. And he thought, not bad. I made it to 32. That's more than most people with cystic fibrosis. And there was a tunnel. And there at the end of the tunnel, guess what? There's a light. And Don said he went over to the edge of the tunnel. He's putting his hand through this tunnel to see what it's made of and trying to figure it out. And there's a voice that says, Donald. And he said, what? It says, come up here, Donald. So he zips up the tunnel to the light, and behind the light was God the Father waiting for him. Said, come and be with me now, Donald, and you'll know more happiness than you could ever have imagined was possible. He said, how am I worthy of that? I mean, that's a huge reward. And God says to Don, because of the pain you suffered, you learned as much in 37 years as most of my children learn in 87 years. Don said, why did I have to suffer all that pain? And he was told, well, you chose the pain you'd suffer and the means by which you'd suffer. And Don essentially says, you're joking. Well, apparently God wasn't joking, because the next thing is he sees himself in a group of people, and there's a man in front of them, and he's talking to them, and he's saying, these are the things you can expect to learn if you go to Earth and take on a physical body. And he said, now, there are two ways to learn on Earth, fast and slow. The fast way always involves some kind of pain. For example, cystic fibrosis. And then he turned and he wrote the word cystic fibrosis in front of the group. So Don and I were talking one day. Call and with him and asked, what language was it in? And he laughed and said, well, I'm sure I instant. And he said that the dream, that the vision. Strange stuff happened. I somehow went offline for a second. Clearly, there are spiritual entities that don't want you to know about this. Either that, or I'm an idiot when it comes to running computers. Now, you pick whichever explanation you think is better of those two. I know what I'd pick. So Don said it was in English because it was presented to me as a vision, and so it was presented in a way that I could see it and learn it and understand it. Now, what do we learn from that? I think the message we learn is that a tough life in some ways is actually a very blessed life. Why? Because you're learning at an accelerated rate. You're learning a lot faster. Don said he, in the vision, he suddenly remembered what was in his heart. And it was, now be careful, you don't know what pain is, you don't know what you're getting into here. But he went ahead and he raised his hand and he said, I'll volunteer for that. So the idea is that, you know, people that have had tough lives, they've learned a lot more than the people who have easy lives. Gosh, you know, maybe we should feel sorry for people who don't have pain and trials and difficulties and tribulations. People will say, Lynn, how are you doing? I said, better than I deserve. Well, maybe I'm kind of a fool for having chosen such an easy life, but I do think my life has been better than I would deserve it to be. So if that's the case, if we live before we come to Earth, and if we plan out in this kind of strange looking glass device if we plan out the trajectory of our life and if we plan out the trials and the difficulties and the challenges we have, then maybe the idea that somehow God is terribly unjust for allowing there to be cruelty in the world, maybe that's a rather foolish idea, because perhaps there needs to be places where there's a lot of trouble and a lot of difficulty, and people can learn a lot in the years that they're given to live on earth. So I thought that is a worthwhile lesson that I think I've taken great enjoyment in. And when I've had patients that said, their lives are really difficult, I'd say, well, let's pretend something for a minute. Let's say that I were some great spiritual guru, which I am not. I am not saying that. But let's pretend I'm a spiritual guru with great insight. And I say to you, suppose I could tell you that before you were born, you picked all those difficulties and trials. And you did it because you wanted to learn something. Now, just, I'm not saying that's true. Just pretend that's true. What do you think you might have wanted to learn by going through the challenges you've gone through? So with that, Martin has more thoughts and insights, and I'm going to invite him to jump back in.
Lynn, thank you. I'm so glad you brought up Don Wood, who's wonderful, and Elaine Durham. It's been many years since Elaine has come to one of our IONS meetings and given a presentation, because she has had so many health problems that most of you listening probably have not had the chance to meet or hear Elaine. In some ways, I'm sad to let everybody know that Elaine passed away just a few months ago on March 29th. But in some ways, I'm happy for her, because the trials of her life are now gone and she's in a much, much happier place. I learned a few wonderful stories. I heard a few wonderful stories from her about her near-death experience that taught great things. And I'd like to elaborate on that in ways that Lynn did not. When 9/11 happened, I remember watching awestruck and in horror on TV, but I had some pressing things at work. So by the time 10:30 or 11 rolled around, I just had to leave, and I went out in the driveway to get in my car. And right as I was getting in my car, my phone rang and it was Elaine. And she said, Martin, this is one of those things that I saw. This is one of those things that I saw in my experience. And people have heard Elaine say that and wondered, well, wait a minute, if you knew about this ahead of time, you know, why wouldn't you explain it? And the simple answer is because you don't know how, because we know what 9/11 is now, but how would you explain it in the future? She saw it as a big calamitous event involving a downtown city. She didn't even really identify it as New York, because her experience had happened so much earlier. And it was quite amazing to me to hear that. The other question that brought up, which dovetails into the question, if you're thinking about this, that Lynn brought up, is, well, wait a minute, if we have free will in this life, and if we have the ability to make choices, really make choices in this life, how is it the things can be predetermined? How can we have our life all mapped out and yet somehow have free will? And I remember thinking about that and wondering about that, and how can that possibly be? And, you know, and is Calvin right, or are the free will advocates right? And how does this all fit together? And I, at one point, talked to a young girl who had a near-death experience. She wasn't very old. And I remember somehow after experience talking to her about this issue in sort of simple form, because she was just a kid. And she looked up at me and said, "Well, we get to choose everything, but that doesn't mean we haven't planned at all. Haven't you ever had a day planner?" And I thought, that's a pretty astute answer from a kid. Just because you have a day planner, just because you plan out your life, in effect, doesn't mean that you can't make choices with respect to what's in your day planner. And I thought that was a very simple and elegant way to resolve that. It dovetailing into that, I had numerous conversations with Elaine Durham about the future, because she said she had seen 9/11 in the future. And my question to her was, well, was it set in stone? Do people have choices about the future? Or was this something that was absolutely unalterable? And she thought about that for a minute and said, no, I was told that we all make individual choices, and those in turn come together like ripples in a pond, so that there are results that are comprised of all of our individual choices. And she said, what I'm trying to say is that society can make choices, the world can make choices, just as individuals can. And she said that 9/11 had not been inevitable, it was just the result of choices. And all of the future is not set in stone, it is subject to individual decisions. And that made a great deal of sense to me. I wanted to mention one other experience that was very powerful for me, because it was something that skeptics have a hard time overcoming. When I was first involved in near-death experiences and interviewing people who had them, I was initially skeptical. I was hoping that they were real, but I did not know for sure. I interviewed a lot of people, finally became convinced that they were real. But perhaps the most difficult experience to refute is the one that happened to the Nashville singer, not very well known, but a wonderful musician, a guitarist and folk singer, Pam Reynolds. She had a brain tumor and went around to a number of different doctors and was unable to find a neurosurgeon who was willing to do the surgery, because her tumor is located in such a difficult place, right at the base of her brain on the inside. Finally, she found a neurosurgeon in Arizona at the Barrow Neurological Institute. His name was Robert Spetzler. Spetzler was an agnostic or an atheist, depending on which interview of him you happen to see. But he agreed to do Pam Reynolds' surgery. And the surgery consisted of course, putting her under general anesthetic, lowering her body temperature to close to 60 degrees, stopping her heart, stopping her respiration. Then they put earbuds into her ears and put a little chirping noise in them. And after her brain waves completely stopped, meaning her ears could no longer perceive the chirping sound, they knew it was ready to start the surgery. She had no heartbeat, no respiration, no brain waves. She was clinically, and by every definition that we know, she was dead. And during the course of her surgery, her spirit left her body and she was able to watch for a time before she went to some other places and saw other events. Before she did that, she was able to see what was happening in the course of her surgery. And one of the things that she described after she was revived and woke up, meaning, of course, that the surgery was successful, was she told Dr. Spetzler that she saw it. He kind of chuckled and thought, yeah, sure you did. you had no sight. Her face was covered. You had no hearing. You had no way to smell. Your lungs were stopped. Your heart was stopped. You had no respiration. You had nothing. You had none of the five senses. You couldn't have seen anything that happened or heard it. Okay, tell me what you saw. And she described that he cut open her skull with something that looked like a metal electric toothbrush. And he was shocked, because when you tell somebody that there's a bone saw that cuts through your skull, you think of some kind of a saw. And this, according to Dr. Spetzler, really does look like a metal electric toothbrush. It had a very fine saw on the end of it, but the shape was pretty much like an electric toothbrush. And he listened more intently, and she described many of the details of the surgery. The point of that is, after she woke up, if you have a neurosurgeon and nursing staff who corroborate what somebody described happened in an operating room from someone who was completely clinically dead and could not have learned that information from any source and could not have learned it from their own five senses, what's the conclusion other than that this was a genuine event? This was a real event where somebody's spirit actually left their body. And when I've had some debates with skeptics and discussions with them, this is one of the very few near-death experiences that is not just something that you take on faith. It's something that is extremely difficult to get around, because you have medical records that were kept in great detail. And if it wasn't real, then you have to say, well, this country music lady and her neurosurgeon and all the staff got together and concocted the story, which is utterly outlandish. That the simple explanation is the most logical, which is that she really had that experience. Similar one happened in Seattle with Vicki Noritok, who had been blind from birth and was able to see during her near-death experience. There's no accounting for things like this other than the explanation that your spirit is separate from your physical body, and when you die, it goes onto the next life. With those two stories, back to you, Lynn.
Aren't those amazing experiences? I just, they're, you know, Elaine was such a blessing for us to know. Don was a tremendous blessing. These people that have had these experiences, they're like a beacons of light, you might say. They're like a beacon in the darkness, and you can see that light and you can move toward it. And it's just so amazing to learn these things. Now, let's see, we've been at this for about 50 minutes. Martin, let's you and I dialogue for a second. Should we take any questions at this point, or?
Yeah, let's do one more quick story apiece, and then let people ask all the questions they want. And let's take 2 minutes to do one more.
Well, yeah.
Does that sound all right? Or something real quick?
Oh yeah, that'd be great. What about Crystal, Melvin Morse's patient? That's a great one, isn't it?
Go for it.
Okay. Melvin Morse, pediatric emergency room physician. And he did circuits. He liked to, he worked out of Washington State, but he liked to do circuits. And he was in Pocatello, and they bring in a girl who was at the bottom of the swimming pool. Bad situation. Her pupils are fixed and dilated. That's a bad sign. They bring her in, they tape her eyes shut, and he intubates her. Usually you put a tube down a throat when you intubate. His training had been to intubate children through their nose, and you put them, the intubation down their nose and getting some oxygen to her lungs, and doesn't have much hope. I mean, in the, who knows how long she was in the swimming pool, doesn't look good for her. And, but, you know, he did everything he could and try and got her somewhat stabilized. And he came in the next morning and they said, Dr. Morse, that young girl that you worked with in the ER, she's sitting up and she's talking. He was astonished. I mean, how can that be? And so he goes in and smiles and said, good morning, I'm Dr. Morse. You don't remember me, but I took care of you when you were brought into the hospital. Crystal looked at him kind of severely and says, I do remember you, and I don't think I like you. And he said, what do you mean? And she said, well, I watched you put those tubes down my nose, and I didn't like you doing that. And then you poked needles in my arms, and I didn't like any of those things. And I was not very happy about what you were doing. Now, this is all impossible. Her brain waves would be flat at that point. Her eyes were closed. She couldn't have seen these things. She couldn't have known what was going on. And yet she did. Morse was kind of an agnostic, atheist sort of fellow. And over the years, he became 100% convinced that people have a spiritual essence within them that survives death. And as we've talked tonight, it's before you're born and it's after you die. There's a continuous kind of quality to that. And then the things that happen to you, chances are pretty darn good that you planned them out. There are visions of the future, but I don't think we ought to get too excited about that part of it, because frankly, I remember what these angels told Howard Storm, and he said, what's the future of America? And they said, oh, it could be this, it could be this, could be. And they showed him a series of visions, and he was a little frustrated with these visions. He didn't like them, and he said, now, wait a minute, you know what's going to happen. Don't tell me what could happen, you know, because all these futures were contingent futures. If you make this choice, a you, meaning the plural you, all of you in the world, all of you in America, if you make these choices, this is what happens. And if you make those choices, that's what's going to happen. And he said, you guys know what'll happen. Now, don't tell me the possible things. Tell me what will happen. And the angel said, well, we can't do that. Why not? Because that would limit your freedom to choose. All we can tell you is what's likely to happen if this direction continues. So that's a pretty good story. And we really should take some questions, comments, visions, whatever you've got. Give us anything you'd like to touch base on. Let's see if this chat thing has any questions in it. Oh, there's a couple of them. Janet says, I love Don Woods. Yes, we did. We love John Woods. Barry Kirk says, he had a near-death experience, and he's talked to me about it. It's wonderful to hear. Barry, glad that he's there. here's Barbara saying, pondering, I don't expect an answer. Well, okay, I won't give you one then. But I can't help but wonder if we choose the main lessons of our life. Did some spirits choose to do bad things to help others learn lessons? Well, see, that's a tough one. People have freedom to choose. I think Martin and I would agree on that. And here's the thing. If you're a believing Christian, then you're kind of in a box. And the box is, if you believe in Jesus, you kind of have to believe in his antagonist, because the New Testament is full of stories where Satan played a role. So if we've got positive forces trying to influence us to do well, we also have some negative forces trying to influence us to do evil. Now, there's a woman named Cassandra Musgraves. She's changed her name, by the way. I looked her up a while back, and she's got some, so I guess she's remarried or something. But Cassandra came down here and gave us her experience. And one of the things she saw is that she and her mom had this headbutting relationship. They just couldn't get along. It was just, you know, terrible relationship. In her near-death experience, she was clearly shown that her mother had agreed to do that because Cassandra wanted to learn some lessons that could only be learned if she were in a very fraught, difficult, tense relationship. So to some extent, you might choose to be kind of a cranky person in order to help somebody else learn. Now, I don't know if that's always the case or what. It's well beyond what I can figure out.
I have a comment on that. Emanuel Swedenborg, who lived in the mid 1700s, claimed to have had a number of experiences where he saw visions of heaven, people appeared to him, and he learned some of the lessons of life. And one of his most fascinating comments is a whole, all of his works comprise many, many, many volumes, but his most famous one, which you can find in all kinds of bookstores because it gets reprinted over and over and over again, I'm sure you could find it on Amazon, is Of Heaven and Hell. And in that particular book, Swedenborg makes this comment about this life, and the gist of it is, we are sent here to earth where we are suspended between heaven and hell so that we can freely choose between the two and be influenced by both. That's the gist of his comment. And we are here and we are pushed and confronted by so many difficulties, Lynn, as you pointed out at the very beginning, that we are bound to slip and make errors in many, many circumstances and trials that we undergo in our life. And because of that, Barbara's question is, do we choose to do evil? Well, I can't imagine that someone would deliberately choose to do something bad, either to themselves or someone else. But we may choose to be in circumstances that are so very difficult that that's what winds up happening, and we do learn from them. And if our heart's right, then we learn from the good as well as the bad. We learn from the very most difficult things as well as some of the easier things. So that would be my comment about how to try to resolve that seeming difficulty and inconsistency.
Well, I like that answer pretty darn well. I just looked on Abe Books for Between Heaven and Hell. There's a whole bunch of them. I can't tell who wrote them. So that's around if you want to look on. Now, I don't ever use Amazon. If I can get out of it, I use Abe Books, A-B-E Books, B-O-O-K-S.
Or Barnes & Noble or any of them.
Barnes & Noble, I'd rather use Barnes & Noble than Amazon. I don't know. That's just because I think I don't need to pay for rockets. Anyhow, good question. Anybody else?
One more comment here. And that is, some people may have come in after the beginning of our start tonight. Next month, we are back at our location in person, but you can also join us via Zoom next month if you choose. A regular location is the auditorium of the Salt Lake County Complex at 2100 South and State Street, 7 o'clock. And so we'll be resuming in-person meetings next month, but next month will be a dual meeting, and we'll have somebody in person starting next month and onward through the end of the year, and hopefully for many, many years to come. Any other questions? Looks like we have a couple of more that have our needless spirits. It's okay. No, I guess that's the one we had before. I had one other quick comment that I didn't want to escape because it's on a completely different topic than we brought up so far. Years ago, I interviewed a really interesting guy who had very little formal education, and he liked to ride his motorcycle. And this was decades ago when it wasn't, not as many people wore helmets. So he was out riding around by Grantsville off, I think it was in Skull Valley, but it might've been in Grantsville. It was off out there west of Salt Lake City. And he goes across a set of railroad tracks, and it dumped him off his bike, and he whacked his head on the pavement, and there were no cars. And it took a long, long time to have somebody show up. In the intervening time period, he left his physical body and was taken up above the world by Jesus. And I'm listening to this guy who probably dropped out of fourth grade or something close to that, talk about the universe and the stars and, you know, the future and different things. And he said, and Jesus said, ask me anything. And he said, I asked him everything, you know, where everything came from and what was going to happen. And he told me everything. And I said, great, you know, tell me which horse is going to win next Thursday at this, you know, at the races. And he said, I can't tell you that. And not only that, I can't tell you most everything that I learned because it's been taken away from me, but I know that I knew it. The yeah. takeaway from that story is that although we learn in this life, information isn't the issue. This guy had access to all the information that there is, essentially. That's what he was describing. The issue isn't information. The issue is wisdom to properly use it and apply it. And so don't worry so much about gaining information. Learn about the wisdom that it takes to properly apply it. That's the story from Doug Jones, the guy who fell off from his Harley Davidson out there in Skull Valley, which I thought was a wonderful comment, because you often hear in near-death experiences that knowledge is key, and it is. Knowledge is very important, but wisdom to properly apply it is even more important. And with that, I think we ought to, Craig, wrap up our meeting. Back to you, and let's wrap things up unless somebody else has actually asked a new question.
Oh, thanks, Martin and Lynn. That was great. These two have a lot of experience and a lot of wisdom from what they've acquired. And I really appreciate their taking the time. At the last minute, they put all this together. So kudos to both of them. Thank you very much for attending. And I hope to see all of you next month in person. And with that, we'll probably end the meeting.
Thanks a lot, Craig. You did a good job putting it together. I thought it went well. I appreciated being here.
Okay. Thank you, Lynn.